The final report is out on what happened during the sinking of the El Faro, and much of the blame goes to the captain. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9. Also, make sure to listen to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher or through our app. Just ahead, a recap of the final NTSB report into the sinking of the El Faro, taking 33 sailors to their deaths. You can get on the line now with your questions and comments at 549-2937. Then later, it's a great opportunity for local high school students. They can win some serious scholarship money by showing off their oratorical skills. Plus, don't miss it, a special chat with Craig Smith of Jacksonville's own Alhambra Theater on their 50th anniversary. And it's our holiday pledge drive. You can show your financial support for WJCT this week, too. We'll tell you all about that. All of that ahead, but first this hour, the NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, released its final report Tuesday into the sinking of the cargo ship, the El Faro, during Hurricane Joaquin back in 2015. This final report is providing some closure to dozens of grieving families across the First Coast who lost loved ones when the ship went down at sea after leaving Jacksonville. The report places a great deal of blame on Captain Michael Davidson. The report says Davidson did not heed warnings from crew members that they needed to change course to avoid the growing weather danger. Here now to talk about the findings, we welcome Maritime Attorney Rod Sullivan. He's Jacksonville-based and a nationally renowned legal expert on maritime matters. Rod, always good to see you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And WJCT reporter Ryan Bank, who's been covering this story all throughout. Good to see you, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your final thoughts and questions about the definitive and final report onto the sinking of the cargo ship El Faro? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJackson. You can also let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page. Rod Sullivan, let's begin with you. Most of us know the story of the El Faro sinking beneath the ocean during that horrible hurricane that it plowed right into. Lots of cargo, 33 sailors went down as the ship had set out from Jacksonville to San Juan. This is the closure of a two-year, $6 million investigation. They have been exhaustive in documenting what happened here, it seems.
They really have. And, you know, all the fireworks yesterday at the NTSB hearing came really in the last 15 or 30 minutes when the members of the NTSB suggested that the maritime industry enact something that the aviation industry has had for a long time called, they call it cockpit. I'm still thinking about last night. They call it cockpit resource management. And the NTSB, you have to understand, is made up of five members. There are one seat empty, three airline pilots and a public health expert. There's no maritime person on the NTSB. But the pilots said, look, you need to enact in the maritime industry, which we've had in the airline industry for over 10 years, and that's bridge resource management. Now, why that created so much controversy is because it is a sort of criticism of the junior officers on the ship for not communicating more directly and more forcefully to the captain their concerns about the ship's safety. And when this recommendation to amend the report written by staff was made, there were a number of crew member families who got up and stormed out of the meeting. And that just set off, you know, everything. I mean, the public health person on the NTSB says, well, you know, I don't think we should do that. That's blaming the mates for what the captain did. And the guys who were airline pilots said, yeah, and we're not blaming anybody. But, you know, in aircraft, it's the duty of the junior officers to really speak up and advise the captain when they think he's doing something unsafe. And it was a very interesting part of this lengthy hearing.
549-2937, let us know your thoughts on the final report into the sinking of the El Faro. Ryan Banks, so as Rod pointed out, the emotions were raw still 2 years later, as families are still mourning the loss of their loved ones. And the frustration, of course, knowing that this was a tragedy that could have been avoided.
Right. And I've regularly interviewed a number of family members who were at every single hearing for the Coast Guard when they were here in Jacksonville. The Coast Guard actually released their report about 3 months ago, and it is a separate findings, although using a lot of the same information. And there are some there's some divergent points. The first thing is the Coast Guard, although they did level blame on the captain for specific things like the weather data. So that is the information about the track of Hurricane Joaquin, where it was moving. The Coast Guard found that they thought the weather data was actually stale, and it led the captain to make failing
they
decisions.
They were only getting it in six-hour intervals, is that right?
But apparently, according to the NTSB report, that is something that is very common. This is how they get their updates from the National Hurricane Center, and they send out their updated tracks every 6 hours. We kind of know this because of covering Hurricane Irma, especially, mm-hmm. That just passed through Jacksonville. And you can even request specific updates by email, and you can even get an intermediate update in between 3 hours. What the NTSB found was that the Captain Michael Davidson, routinely downloaded these weather updates late. So on top of the fact that perhaps there was some part of the information that had already been kind of stale by the time it got to the captain, he didn't even open the packages on time. And that's one example of sort of the divergence here from the NTSB report and their findings and the Coast Guard. Now, to Rod's point, they basically said that the crew members who, although tried to warn the captain three times and ask him to change course, didn't do enough to really get the captain back on the bridge, back navigating, and to really impress upon him the worry and the concern of this difficult situation. They wanted them to be more assertive.
If you're just tuning in, here's our question to callers right now. What changes do you think the maritime industry needs to make to avoid another tragedy like the sinking of the El Faro? It killed all 33 crew members on board in 2015 when the ship set sail from Jacksonville to San Juan, Puerto Rico, right into the path of Hurricane Joaquin. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. So, Rod, it was literally a perfect storm of bad factors. The captain not paying enough attention, the ship was not in good condition, and there were reasons that the captain had. There was a backstory you've told me before, why the captain was so determined to carry on. He was under pressure from a company that has thin profit margins and wants to get that cargo delivered no matter what. How much did that factor into this?
Well, the truth is that you're not going to get anybody to testify under oath as to what actually happens in the industry. And I don't think it's just in this company. But any captain who works for Tote, Carly, or any other company that is on a frick schedule like this, if you tell the company that you, when you leave here on Wednesday, that you're going to be in port at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, they order a lot of equipment. It's a $40,000 to $100,000 expense to the company if you change your arrival time. So once you have left port, there's a lot of pressure to continue on the same course and to make that arrival time. And captains will tell you off the record, privately, they will never commit to it, that if you come in late, your career anticipation light is blinking. You know, you're going to be eased out of the company. And therefore, there was a lot of pressure on Davidson.
Right, and I think that goes to another divergent point between the Coast Guard report and the NTSB report, or at least the Coast Guard hearings. Now, the Coast Guard report did not end off with a finding that there was direct evidence to suggest that the company pressured Davidson to be there on time. However, there was a lot of discussion during those Coast Guard hearings. There were 6 weeks of them about whether or not this pressure did exist. And there was a lot of evidence that was brought up, certain emails and phone calls that could have suggested pressure was being applied to Davidson. He was already on thin ice because of some problems that he had interpersonally and with his leadership. And he was worried that the El Faro was going to go off to the Alaskan trade and he was going to be basically left without a ship to captain. Now, the NTSB, on the other hand, basically flat out denied that there was any evidence of direct pressure by the company. They said that almost in those exact words, there is no direct evidence that Davidson was directly pressured by Tote. However, they said there obviously was an inherent pressure that exists with most captains, but even more specifically with Davidson's particular situation.
Let's go to some calls. The Spanish word El Faro means the lighthouse. But for Jacksonville and the national maritime industry, it has come to signify one of the worst tragedies involving a commercial ship at sea in many, many years. What are your thoughts about the final report into the sinking of the El Faro? It's 549-2937. Let's begin with Ricky on the north side. Hi, Ricky. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm calling because my question is, what would have happened to the crew if they had declared mutiny on the Bounty? In other words, they would have taken over the captain and had the ship safely home or wherever they needed to go. What would have happened to the crew once they got here and all of them would have been safe and the fire would still be would not have sunk, period.
Sure.
That's my question.
Thank you for that. That's a good question, Ricky. So was Captain Davidson like Fletcher Christian? Should the crew have mutinied? Do you think they would have even considered it, Rod Sullivan? And what would have happened to them if they had?
Well, Ricky actually anticipates the debate that the NTSB had, which is, you know, there's this balance between shipboard discipline and the need for officers to communicate with the captain. And their argument was that the junior officers weren't forceful enough.
They tried, but not forcefully enough?
Not forcefully enough. And if now, we couldn't listen to the tape. The tapes themselves are not available to the public. But the NTSB officers who listened to the tape said, no, they were a little bit too deferential to the captain. They weren't firm enough in passing on their warnings. And that was a big criticism.
And is that due to a military-style chain of command on these ships? People are afraid to challenge authority, even if it's a life or death situation?
I think there are a couple of things at play here. And let me just say that when I was at sea, I spent 5 years at sea. Three times I called for the captain, and all three of those times the captain came up to the bridge. This captain was called three times and didn't come up to the bridge at all. So it is different ships have different cultures. And the culture, I think, in this case, with this ship being laid up, with a lot of officers with towed, not sure what their future was, they didn't want to, in my opinion, they probably didn't want to make waves. And Davidson didn't want to make waves either. And that might be part of the explanation.
Ryan Bank.
Right. I mean, I think we did get to read the transcript, as Rod said. We didn't get to hear the tape, so we don't know the inflection. We don't know the emotion that was necessarily behind it. We did hear some of the emergency calls that Davidson made, and you could definitely hear, as that was about right as the ship was going down, you could hear the emotion in his voice and how worried he obviously was. As for what the crew's communication was with the captain, that wasn't that's not really as available to us as some of the other aspects of this case. And now another thing is going back to the condition of the ship and its instruments, the VDR, the voice data recorder, voyage data recorder, which is basically the black box for these ships, which give us all these transcripts of these conversations, didn't even record. It was not set up properly, so it could not record the other side of a conversation to the navigation bridge, which is basically the control room for the ship. It would only record what was happening on the bridge. And of course, the captain wasn't there for a full 8 hours. So we don't even know exactly what kinds of conversations could have been going on between the captain other than those three calls for him to come up to the bridge, which he ignored.
Okay, so Rod Sullivan, you followed this throughout, and as I mentioned, you're a nationally regarded expert on maritime matters. How has the El Faro tragedy changed this industry? What will come out of this tragedy that might hopefully save lives in the future?
Well, the very first thing that's happened is the Coast Guard has sort of revamped its alternative compliance program and went back and inspected these old ships. And as a result of these increased inspections, three ships were laid up. And then Tote, realizing that it had a problem, laid up the El Yunque. And so we don't have as many 40-year-old ships operating today as we did as we did 2 years ago. So that's been a good effect. Now Ryan and I were discussing beforehand that the Coast Guard has ramped up its review of American Bureau of Shipping inspections of these ships and has found that it doesn't think that the American Bureau of Shipping is doing an adequate job inspecting these old ships, and they have to figure out how they're going to do that.
Hmm.
Now, that's what's happened so far. What I expect to see happen in the future is they're going to get rid of these old open-top lifeboats that launch from the side. These are the same lifeboats that were on the Titanic, the Lusitania, the Morro Castle.
100-year-old lifeboat style.
We have known about this problem for 100 years, that if a ship
that's
is listing
incredible.
To one side, you can't launch these lifeboats.
And it's been a requirement of new ships for a very long time,
yes.
To Rod's point, to have these enclosed, self-propelled lifeboats, mm-hmm. which could have saved the crew. Nothing is for sure, as the NTSB board
said. Old ships are still going out to sea that have these problematic safety
features?
I think
there are 40 U.S. ships of this age that still have the older type lifeboats. If you ever saw the Tom Hanks movie on the ship, the Maersk, Alabama, where the captain was put off with the hijackers, that's the type
of... The Somali pirates.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the kind of lifeboats that would have saved lives in this case. And then there was actually a question from one of the airline pilots on the NTSB as well, would this have guaranteed their safety? I can answer that question. If you're in one of those enclosed lifeboats, so you get it off the ship, you're going to survive. It doesn't matter what the weather is.
Okay, let's go to a few more calls on the final report issued yesterday in Jacksonville at an emotional hearing from the National Transportation Safety Board into the sinking of the El Faro cargo ship. It took 33 sailors with it down to the ocean floor in 2015 when the maritime ship set sail from Jacksonville carrying cargo bound for San Juan, Puerto Rico. What are your final questions about this as the book is finally closed on the El Faro tragedy? It's 549-2937. Chuck is at the beaches. Hey, Chuck, good morning.
Hi, guys. You were just touching base on what I was thinking about with the rescue boats. And my question is, how much do they cost? And we have in the construction industry OSHA. And OSHA will take you to task if you don't have equipment necessary on site, and why doesn't this industry have something like OSHA that requires these people to have these boats? How much does it cost for the boat, and how much would it cost the industry to make sure that their employees would be able to survive in that rescue boat during a hurricane?
Thanks for that question, Chuck. What's the price tag on this?
Well, I'll take the second part of the question first. I think Rod might know what the price tag on those actual boats were, but I did want to address something. The reason why these ships have these older models of lifeboats and safety equipment is because they were specifically exempted from the law that was passed by Congress to mandate them on newer ships. Because of its age, El Faro was able to continue on with these open lifeboats, whereas newer ships would not be. Now, it's also worthy to mention that had El Faro's conversion that it underwent in 1992, I believe, 92 or 93, had that conversion been deemed a major conversion or something that affected the safety of the ships or the lifeboats, then they may have had to update their safety equipment. But because the Coast Guard did not consider it a, quote, major conversion, they didn't have to update it. They weren't under the new regulations. For the cost, I'm sure Rod has estimates on that.
Well, here my understanding is the best information I've got is that the boats themselves are about $100,000 each, and they seat 10 to 12 people, so you would need three at least on a ship like the El Faro to accommodate the crew. The larger cost is the modification of the ship, and that's about $250,000 per boat. So you're looking at a cost of $750,000 to $1 million to change
per
over.
Per ship. So that's significant, but let me ask you, is this an instance of a corporation once again being penny wise and pound foolish, not investing in the right equipment to safeguard their staff and personnel? Because now, of course, there are many lawsuits that TOTE is facing from these families who've lost their loved ones. What's the final tab likely to be there, Rod?
Well, I'm sworn to secrecy on the final tab of what the personal injury settlements were, but I can tell you that they were far in excess of what it would have cost to modify all of Tote's vessels to have these new lifeboats on board. So I think the answer to the question is that it is penny wise and pound foolish, and that they ought to be changing over to these fully enclosed lifeboats.
There's also other issues, equipment that could have been purchased, which is a personal EPIRB or navigation beacons that each sailor now is recommended to have and carry with them, or each mariner is recommended to carry with them, that would have given the GPS location of each individual after the ship went down, so that it would have been easier for the Coast Guard during their search and rescue. El Faro only had one EPIRB, and it was for the entire ship, and it was not up to date.
Let's go to Mark on the west side. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm an old Navy officer. I have 8 years of time out at sea, and we had something, this is back 30 years ago, that, like what you were talking about earlier about the, how to talk to the captain, communication skills, that kind of thing. But my question is this, I can't imagine that Tote would somehow profit by all this, but maybe, if they insured their ships for 200% and their ships sank, let's keep it out at sea. What do we care, really? For the bottom line, we're going to make money on this. I mean, maybe was that some of their thinking, perhaps?
No.
No. Okay. Thanks for the question, Mark.
Yeah. Ships don't have insurance the way you and I have insurance. They belong to pools called P&I clubs, and they self-insure each other so that they sort of keep an eye over each other, that the vessels aren't over-evaluated, and that they, keep the risks low. So the ones who are going to pressure Tote or any other ship operator to keep their losses down are other ship owners.
Thank you both so much for providing your insights as this tragedy of the El Faro, this long-running story you've both been following, is finally at an end. We'll continue to follow, though, the journey of the families seeking restitution. Rod Sullivan, maritime attorney with us, and also our own WJCT reporter Ryan Bank. Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
All right, and much more still ahead. Later, it's the 50th anniversary of Jacksonville's Alhambra Theater, the longest-running dinner theater in the country. CEO Craig Smith will join us. But up next, here's how you can show your support for WJCT and First Coast Connect.
All you need to do is pick up that phone and make that call to 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528. Good morning. I'm Kevin Mersch, our producer for First Coast Connect. Hope you're enjoying this program. A great, lively discussion on the El Faro. We have more things to talk about. We got, you have a high school student, American Legion may have something for you if your kid has some great auditory skills. And, of course, the Alhambra and the 50th anniversary. Just some of the things that we bring you every single day on First Coast Connect. We're here for you because we know that this is important to you. Just the other day, we were talking, Melissa and I were sitting down talking to our incoming CEO, David, and we talked about how the show, how popular it is, the great number of listeners who come on, all the people who the movers and shakers in town who listen and are always willing to come on to talk to people like you, because where else can you just sit there and have a conversation with the entire community? Well, that's what's important to them. They like to come on and talk to you, ask your questions. They give the answers. They want you to know what's going on with what they're doing. And same thing with lots of other groups, nonprofit organizations, and others in town. They come on and they talk to you. It's always a great time. The other day, I got an email back from one of the groups in town who are doing a Going Green segment. And he said, hey, you know what? I got back to the office and there were like 7-8 phone calls for people asking me about what we do, but just some advice on of what to do to help make the planet place a greener planet and what kind of things they can plant and stuff like that. And said, hey, I want to thank you. He goes, well, thank you, because that's why we're here. We're here to offer advice, give information to the people of the First Coast that you're not going to get anywhere else. And the only way it's made possible, quite frankly, only way is because listeners like you show your financial support. We need about 1,000 more new supporters to reach our goal of 4,500 for the calendar year of 2017. That's why we're here to wrap up here in December. So make that call now. $10 a month on your credit card. Real easy. Just make the call. Become a sustainer at 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org. Every day we bring you a great program, not just First Coast Connect. There's Morning Edition. There's 1A, there's Fresh Air, there's All Things Considered, there's our newest program, the Statewide Florida Roundup, that Melissa co-hosts with Tom down in Miami, and I am the co-producer of that program. Matter of fact, when we get off the air here, a little after that, we're going to have a nice little phone call, talk about what we should talk about this week. So make a call. Show your support for this great programming that we bring you every single day. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org. And thank you very much for your support for this, your public radio station.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, February 10th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 and 2017 events will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues, learn new ways to engage students, and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets today at wjct.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, the American Legion has an interesting contest coming up. It's their high school oratorical contest, and it's a chance for high school students around this region to develop a deeper knowledge and appreciation for the U.S. Constitution. And some serious scholarship money is available here. Some of the most generous college scholarships around. Right now, we welcome Jan Vandelinder. She's a speech and debate teacher at Yulee High School up in Nassau County. Jan, a pleasure to see you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
This is an amazing opportunity for high school students because they can learn public speaking, learn about the Constitution, and wow, some huge scholarships are up for grabs as well. Exciting.
It really is. Last year, Madison Moore, who was a student at Yulee High School, won the state competition, and she had begun working in the competition when she was a freshman and won some scholarship money then, competed, and then last year won the state level, won $2,500, I believe, and was able to go on to national competition. But as you were saying earlier, it's really a wonderful opportunity for them to develop research skills because they really learn a great deal about the Constitution. In fact, one of the reasons I enjoy coaching students for this is because I learn every year. Mm-hmm. They bring up Supreme Court cases related to different amendments and articles, and they develop their speaking skills and their organizational skills. Wonderful preparation for college in addition to the scholarship money.
Right. The national first place winner gets $18,000.
Yes.
That could pay for 4 years of college at many institutions.
Yes. And last year, I was able to go to nationals along with Madison and was able to hear those students that won. But it was a extremely well-done competition. It was just the highest level of competition, and I've been involved in speech and debate for many years, but it was outstanding competition.
Now, the big oratorical contest is coming up in February of 2018, but you wanted to come on the program this morning so that kids can start getting ready along with help from their parents, because this is tough. They have to deliver an 8 to 10 minute memorized speech. There can be no notes.
Absolutely
they get
not.
Up and it's oratory.
Yes.
That's tough. I know from doing some public speaking myself, a lot of prep work has to go into this.
It does. And then the second level that they do is they draw an article or amendment, one of four, and they present a 3 to 5 minute speech on that. They do not know till they arrive at the competition which of those four articles or amendments they will be speaking on, so they have to, of course, be prepared to speak on any of them. So it gives them oration experience, gives them some extemporaneous speaking experience also, and just really, really interesting competition. But I would not deceive anyone here. It is a lot of work. And
you're going to earn that scholarship.
They absolutely do.
How can students apply and start preparing to enter this oratorical contest?
Well, Mary West is the oratorical chairman for our Florida, Northeast Florida area, and her phone number is 704-0936. And if you want additional information about when the competitions will be, I know the district, as you mentioned, is February the 10th. Prior to that, some posts have a competition. If they have more than one entrant and have to decide who they're sponsoring as a post, they have a competition usually late in January. Mm-hmm. So they would want to get in touch with Mary right away so that they could get the work done and have the preparation done for the competition.
And if you're out, say, maybe driving around and you miss that phone number, just contact WJCT and we'll get you connected. Just email me at mross@wjct.org. And this is available to any high school senior?
No, any high school.
Any high school student, period.
In fact, 25 years ago, my son won the City of Indianapolis when he was a freshman. That's actually how I was first involved with this. And Madison began as a freshman. So they acquire good skills as they're working.
They can enter every year they're in high school.
Yes, and it can be public schools, private schools, homeschoolers.
And this is scholarship money that goes to vocational programs, too.
I believe so. Yeah. I don't know the details, but I believe it's not restricted.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing scholarship opportunity. The American Legion High School Oratorical Contest. Start those applications and start that prep work right now for the big event in February of 2018. Thanks for being here, Jan Vandelinder. You are a speech and debate teacher and coach at Yulee High School, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of applications out there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, Craig Smith on Alhambra Theater's 50 Years of Entertainment.
Catherine Burns, one of the hosts of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us here on 89.9 WJCT. With true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world, Moth stories aren't part of the disposable daily information flow. They stick with you, and you'll even find yourself retelling them. Listen Saturdays at 3 p.m. here on 89.9 WJCT.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
From electronica to blues, listen to After Hours Monday through Friday at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, he's the man who brought the Alhambra Theater back from the dead, literally. Craig Smith rescued the Alhambra after it had closed its doors during the recession some years back. Craig decided that the Alhambra was too precious to go away, so he reopened the venue, the longest-running dinner theater in America, with a new menu, new decor, and fresh new productions. Ever since, the Alhambra has been packing them in, and now they're celebrating their 50th anniversary. With a look back and a look forward, we're pleased to welcome the impresario of the Alhambra, Craig Smith, to Studio 5. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's so good to have you. And I remember right back when all this started in 2009 and you decided to fix up the Alhambra, you were one of the very first guests to appear on this program when we launched. So now look at you.
Look at you and what you've accomplished in these 8 years. And so I think Wayne Weaver was the day before me. And then
he was guest number one.
I got a full hour that day. I think you were one of our
very first guests. So I'll never forget that.
I won't as well. And I appreciate all your support since. It has been a phenomenal 8 years. The way the community has supported the theater and supported our efforts have just been overwhelming.
It's incredible because what a legacy. The Alhambra opened in 1967.
Today. 50 years ago. Today. We celebrated Monday, but it's today.
It's an amazing anniversary because, as many know, dinner theaters were struggling, particularly in 2008 and 2009 when the bottom fell out of the economy and the Alhambra closed. You got wind of that and you were really saddened by it. And you decided, no, I'm not going to let this stand. You bought up the Alhambra and turned it around. That was not an easy thing to do.
It was not an easy thing. It was the right thing. We actually celebrated Monday, and five people in the audience Monday night were there 50 years ago on opening night. And I said to the audience, I said, you know, when you open a business, your expectation is to pay your bills, pay your employees, and maybe, if you're lucky, make a little money. Never do you think, I'm starting a community icon. I'm creating a legacy for five decades of families. And yet, it's what happened. And here we are 50 years later. I was able to be fortunate enough. Harry Frisch and I love the Alhambra and certainly didn't want it to go away. And some dear friends of mine, Bill Barnett and Frazier, and wanted to jump in. And here we are 8 years later and 50 years from the beginning.
Now, you had a strategy when you resuscitated the Alhambra. You did a lot of things to make it a more attractive venue. You revamped the exterior and the interior, and you completely jazzed up the menu. You have an amazing chef, Chef Dewan Roy, and when people come to see a show at the Alhambra, and these are Actors Equity shows, by the way, professional shows, they're going to have a really good meal as well.
They are going to have a great meal. Most of my clothes from 2009 would not fit today, thanks to Chef. But he has. He's really done a great job. People love it. Quite frequently, the voice on the other end of the phone will say, now, what's the menu one more time? Because I can get my husband to go if it's this or if it's that, if it's the chicken, if it's the prime rib.
Yeah.
And so quite often, he'll sell some tickets just based on what's on the menu.
How are you choosing shows, too? Because every time I drive by, I see a packed parking lot. Oh, I'm not kidding you. Every single time I'm driving down Beach Boulevard on a show night, the parking lot is full.
Melissa, it's been so good. We've basically been sold out from September till now through the end of the year. We have a few seats, you know, at Christmas for the matinees. But we've basically been sold out. Kind of the mix is, you know, we try to do a couple of the old classics. We sprinkle in. We did Adam's Family. We just finished Adam's Family. Probably the best show Todd Booth has put on that stage in his 30 years. mm-hmm. It was better than what I saw on Broadway. And I've never said that before. But try to mix a couple of the old classics, pick a couple of new ones, sprinkle in a good family show. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang's coming this summer. Let's hope we figure out how to make the car fly. But just kind of a mix.
And this is a great opportunity, too, for local and regional talent to get some professional acting experience.
Listen, I tell people all the time, it's like minor league baseball. You're working your way up to the big leagues. Tonight on Broadway, we'll have four or five kids that were with us years ago that are now in the big leagues. The gentleman that played Spider-Man when Spider-Man was in New York, he was with us in 2009, the last show of Todd's era. He left and went to New York, was in Rock of Ages, and then wound up being Spider-Man. And so it is so much the stepping stone. Adam's Family, the entire lead cast, had Broadway credits.
And you bring in stars, too. You bring in celebrities to frontline some of the shows. People come to see the show, enjoy the ambiance, but they sometimes come because you book someone really that they've loved for many years.
This summer we had Morgan Fairchild and Don Wells from Gilligan's Island, and people loved her. It took Don a week or so to kind of get on the page with script, but she was great.
Now, as you think about the 50-year legacy of this institution in Jacksonville, this cultural institution, what's your strategy for the coming years? Because I know you want to make sure that the Alhambra just stays vibrant for many decades to come.
You know, it's so funny you say, because when you grew up on the west side of Jacksonville like I did, I didn't know what Broadway was, much less where it was. And so as the arts and budgets have been cut in schools and kind of the arts have been diminished somewhat in the education system, you know, we'll host 10,000 children a year. And it's so important. I realize how my life's been affected by the arts. And my parents, you know, again, they were country folks. They didn't do a whole lot with the arts. Mm-hmm. I had a neighbor that did. And that's how I wound up, you know, with a love for it. So it's important. It's something I want to keep going for another 50 years.
Didn't you decide to buy the Alhambra in part because your daughter loved it?
Yes, Macy loved it. She was three. We went to see Wizard of Oz. It became our daddy-daughter date spot.
Wow. Now, there's a show happening right now at the Alhambra.
Christmas Carol.
A Christmas Carol.
Todd Booth's the star. In January, we're doing The Marvelous Wonderettes. It's about a girls in their 50s and 60s and all that good music. You'll know every song. People will love that one.
Wow. And as I look at the website, you've got a whole slate of shows going into 2018. You've got Little Shop of Horrors. You've got Five Guys Named Mo, the Tony-nominated Best Musical. I'm not as familiar with that one.
That's a great one.
But that
one
looks really fun. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Kiss Me Kate. That's a classic. Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really Reflect Up? I remember
one
that
one. One of the funniest shows ever.
1776, and then all the way into next Christmas, Elf the Musical.
We're so excited. We've been waiting to do that for years. We're excited. In 1776, I tell everybody, I was kind of the nerd that loved the Hall of the Presidents at Disney World. So if you like Hall of the Presidents at Disney World, you're going to love 1776.
Is Elf the Musical based on the Will Ferrell film?
It is, and it is. I mean, so often when they convert them to a Broadway show, they change so much of it. That one's just spot on.
Wow. So Todd Booth, you mentioned him. He's been with the theater from the start. This is a
25 years.
Or almost from, halfway through.
Ted Johnson and Leon Simon were the original owners in 1967. And Todd bought it in 85. And we bought it from Todd in 2009.
But Todd is a guy who's worked with some of the biggest names in
biggest
show
names,
business.
Biggest names. You name it. He was telling a Shelley Winter story yesterday and about doing some work with Shelley. But he's definitely worked with some big names back in the day.
And now he basically helps stage the productions for you.
He does. When we bought the theater, he says, look, I'm too young to retire and too old to go start over. And I said, well, I know nothing about show business, so I'd sure like to have you stick around.
Yeah, you need a show business expert and a businessman, and the two of you together have done something so special for this community. So I'm so pleased to watch your success and see it grow. And it's always great to see you, Craig. As I said, you were a supporter of our show from the beginning, so we're happy to be a supporter of the Alhambra Theater right back.
Thanks, Melissa. I appreciate everything you've done for me.
Thank you so much. It's 50 years of the Alhambra Theater in Jacksonville. Get your tickets now for A Christmas Carol. They're on stage right now. And you might have missed the 50th anniversary celebration. That was Monday night. But today is the actual anniversary of the Alhambra. So that's quite a milestone for this institution to mark. Again, that website is alhambrajax.com. for tickets. A quick break, and in a moment, we're going to give you an interesting way to celebrate the season this weekend. It's Christmas at Congaree. If you've never been out to Congaree and Penn, the farm and mill in this area, well, this is going to be your chance to enjoy something unique this weekend. We'll tell you about it right after this. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Hey, Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Michael Cavendish and Cavendish Partners PA. Intelligent management of lawsuits for companies, investors, and executives. Offices in downtown Jacksonville. On the web at cavpartners.com.
Alabama's special election has dominated the national dialogue for months. But as they say, all politics is local.
We're going to let the people of Alabama decide.
That's something for the people of Alabama to decide.
I think he thinks it's best for the people of Alabama to make that decision.
The votes are in. What happens next? That's next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, infidelity. Why do people cheat? Does it count as cheating when your spouse no longer knows your name because they have Alzheimer's? Is looking at pornography cheating? We speak with psychotherapist Esther Perel about her work with couples dealing with infidelity. Her new book is called The State of Affairs. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
There's always something new happening in your community and your world. Whether it's Morning Edition tackling topical concerns in a smart, thoughtful way, or First Coast Connect introducing you to local artists and innovators, you can always count on WJCT to share a world of exploration with you. Make a year-end donation to ensure the programs you cherish and rely on continue to thrive throughout the year to come. Give online now at WJCT.org.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, you can celebrate the season this weekend with Christmas at Congaree. It's your chance to visit the Congarean Pen Farm and the Mill. You can check out some amazing local artisans and some food vendors unique to this region. Hang out with Santa, even enjoy a sleigh ride. Scott Meyer of Congaree Pen is here with a preview. Hey, good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me this morning.
And Congaree Pen has really established itself in recent years as this wonderful locally run farm producing locally sourced agriculture. Now you're opening your gates to the whole community. That's exciting.
Yeah, that's right. So beginning in the summertime, we started having an open farm day once a month, and the themes have kind of changed with the seasons. And this will be our second annual Christmas at Congaree, which involves sleigh rides. We're going to have a bounce house. Santa Claus will be there from noon until 3. The farm will actually be open to the public from 11 until 4 p.m. It's just $10 per car. And the sleigh rides, the bounce house, a lot of free activities. Enjoy walking around the farm, experiencing you know, a little bit of something different here in Jacksonville. And we'll have a lot of local vendors there. It's going to be a lot of fun. We have Topsy Toffee, Mayan Summer, which is a kind of traditional Mayan cuisine. And they're going to be roasting green chilies. I know that my wife, Lindsay, is very excited about that because she's from New Mexico.
Very nice. Yeah. You'll have the new Flower and Fig Bakehouse in Springfield, Bold Bean Coffee, the Manifest Distillery, Bee Friends Farm, Creative Grain Studio, lots of local vendors. Now, Congaree and Penn began a few years ago as a small little rice farm. Isn't that right?
And that's correct.
The growth has been incredible.
Yeah, we started just growing rice. And then as we evolved, we began growing mayhaw trees, which is a native crab apple. We have about 3,000 of those planted out in the ground now. And the next phase is going into growing lots of olive trees. So we have 140 larger trees and 12,000 young baby, you know, year and a half old olive trees, which will be going in the ground in the spring of 2019.
You're going to be even having an olive weekend in January at Congaree and Penn. You'll have to come back and talk to us about that. But, you know, you guys are an example of this national movement toward local sustainable agriculture. Why is that so important?
Well, to me, it's most important because, A, you know, Jacksonville's changed a lot since my childhood. And one of the things that I wanted to do was create a business that preserved both the open environment, the open landscape, but also to do something great, have something new and unique from the food system. You know, we've got all these great restaurants, we've got all these great chefs that have really helped us get to where we are today, and we like to kind of continue the effort and do new things, exciting things, whether it be growing mejas, growing olives, which they used to grow in St. Augustine back in the 1700s, and you know, do things that not everyone's doing, but provide a really unique cuisine for Northeast Florida.
If people come out Sunday to Congaree & Penn Farm, it's $10 per car. You're going to open the gates at 11 a.m. And not only can people really enjoy the farm, they can buy some holiday gifts,
too. Oh, there's going to be a lot of great gifts to get, whether it be some of our fresh milled rice or even some of the other great things from Camp Craft Cocktail. They're going to be out there. We're going to have also Topsy Toffee Tucker. He makes some phenomenal toffee. If you haven't had it yet, you've got to get your hands on some. We'll have Jane Doe out there selling some of her delicious donuts. And some of the stuff is going to be more for eating that day, whereas other stuff might be a great stocking stuffer or a great gift for you or your family.
Yeah, and hopefully perfect weather for this. This is such a great family event. It's this Sunday, Christmas at Congaree, at the Congaree & Penn Farm. They're at 11830 Old Kings Road in Jacksonville. Go to congareeandpenn.com for more. Scott Meyer, thanks so much for being here, and I know it's going to be a lot of fun.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. And the theme of our show is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A's up next, and we'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. But in the meantime, we want you to show your financial support for WJCT. Here's how.
Pick up your phone and give us a call at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at wjct.org. Good morning. Kevin Mercer, Dan Koskov is coming in here, a longtime supporter, follower, been in the business a long time and is now in other businesses. It was funny, just outside for talking with Alhambra and said you were there. Really? Back in the early days, you were showing up at stuff there.
I was there when I first came to WJCT in 1968. Went to the Alhambra, which was one of the great institutions in this community, just like this institution right here. Mm-hmm. I was proud to be part of the staff there for 25 years and rewarding years, but most rewarding because of what we were able to do for this community. And we're so excited that you're listening to us right now and that you're willing to make a pledge. We're looking for 1,000+ members before the end of this weekend, right?
That is right. We're only going to be here for 3 days, today, tomorrow, and Friday, and then we're going to wrap it up and get ready for the holiday season. So if you have not become a sustaining member of WJCT yet, now is the time to do so. It's just $10 a month on your credit card. Think about all the great programming you get. Think about listening to First Coast Connect every day. I've run into so many people who talk about how much they love the program, how much they love listening to Melissa every day, how much they love the guests who come in. And I could tell you, when we started this 8 years ago, it was hard. We were getting our figuring out just what we were going to do. And slowly and gradually, it became what is people consider must listening on the First Coast. You want to know what's going on in town? You have to listen to First Coast Connect. I know elected officials and others in town, big the important people who say, oh yeah, every morning I listen to First Coast Connect because I got to know. My job is knowing what's going on in the world, and I got to know what's going on in Jacksonville, and I can only do that with your support. So make that call now. Thank you very much. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.